What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? Lie in the morning. Are you sick and tired of being sick and tired? Being late and being fired? First one drunk and the last one hired? Or lie in the morning? Kids all love you and adore you, but by evening they're looking for you, rowing the lifeboat along beside you every single morning. Loving as much has got me grieving, can't stand by and watch you leaving. No more lies, no more deceiving, the truth comes in the morning. Loving the one the storm is taking, I'm on the shore, my heart is breaking. I'm watching it drowning in the making, it's gonna take me down too. So way, hey, and up he rises, way, hey, and up she rises, way, hey, and up they're rising, drunk again in the morning. Living in guilt and dying in shame, the drunken sailor is not to blame. When he asked for help, well, millions came, and it was a brand new morning. So what do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do with a drunken sailor? What do you do? That question, that age-old question, summed up in countless versions of that centuries-old Anglo-Saxon sea shanty, but asked countless times, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, generation after generation for millennium. And it's been asked by our family members, parents, siblings, extended members of the family, asked certainly by the medical community, asked certainly, of course, by the legal profession, and in my case, the judicial system, but asked by the clergy and other ministers, priests, rabbis, imams, and all of those of the cloth, and just concerned members of society or individuals that knew us as well. All of these individuals who could see what alcoholism was doing to me or us long before I was ever able to see it in my own life. And they wanted to help, and they reached out and they did whatever they could, whether they gave me money or refused to give it, whether they brought me in or kicked me out, whether they helped or disdained, it doesn't matter. They tried in all of the ways that they right from their heart, they tried to offer some help and assistance, and it was all for naught. And in their frustration and despair, they raised their arms up and cried out, "What are we going to do with the likes of someone like me?" And I asked myself that same question, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year. When I find myself hidden away in my little hidey hole, once again at that point of absolute pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, hoping that I had enough of the stuff to get me through to the next, then the next, and the inevitable next, because there was always a next. It might be a next morning or a next day, but there always was going to be another next. And I'd ask myself that question, as I was putting that bottle to my lips, and that bottle was sucking more of the life out of me than I was sucking the booze out of it. And I'd ask myself that question time after time, knowing that there was no answer. I knew my truth by that point, that there was no going forward, that there was no recapturing any glory days, there was no recapturing any relief. That long sought after relief that originally came with a couple, but had vanished long, mightily years ago. And so I asked myself that question. And sadly, there really was no answer to that question for millennium. Oh, sure, there was the occasional, miraculous, recovery, religious conversion. In more recent times, there were some, psychological reliefs found and therapies that had some efficacy. But even then, when they were applied, the ones around the sufferer, and people around me, they were always still on the edge of their seat. Is this the time? Is this the time it's really going to work? Never was. For some people it did, but it didn't work for me. So there really was no answer until about 27 years ago, when a bunch of hapless, down-and-out, gutter-level drunks found themselves banded together, not by virtue, just purely by circumstance, and they began to speak with each other and talk to each other and share their stories with each other, and more importantly, they began to share back and forth with each other some of the things that they had garnered and found useful from members of the religious community and from the medical profession and psychological community as well. And bless you. And they had never found long-lasting relief on their own. But when they banded together and began to tell each other their stories and sort of cobbled, what they really did was cobble together a practical program of action, spiritual in nature, which, when they practiced it as a way of life, a simple way of life, and introduced it to them, you know, to each other, and observed and disciplined each other, they found that it worked. The obsession of drink was removed and they were placed back into a position of usefulness and wholeness. And it surprised the hell out of them. Because nothing else had ever worked. But because this was working and they were enthused about it, they began not only just to work among themselves, they rapidly and quickly went about and began to share this with everyone else that they could find that was also of a similar ilk, suffering from a hopeless case of mind and body. And so they began tearing up the streets and the hospitals and whatnot, and they had mostly a lot of failures and a few occasional successes. And as this small band of recovered alcoholics began to grow in their wisdom, they took this practical program of action, spiritual in nature, and codified it. They codified their experience in this basic text, our book, Alcoholics Anonymous. And they offered it to all who were interested. And when I was at that point of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, awakened members of this sacred fellowship, armed with the facts about themselves, and willing to be useful to someone just like them, approached me and offered me the way out that they had found. And when I introduced it into my life as a way of life, I got the same results as those early members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and every member of Alcoholics Anonymous since that time that has practiced this as a way of life and followed these simple, clear-cut, precise instructions. I've recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. My name is Rob Sipple, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I've been moved from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, surely by the grace of a loving God, the power that I found as a result of the program in this textbook, Alcoholics Anonymous, by the awakened members of this fellowship that led me to and through that program and continue to guide me today, by the service that God leads me to and that I'm allowed and encouraged to participate in, and by a host of teachers in my life, I've been moved from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body to that state that I experience today at this very moment as recovered, free, able to consistently see the truth. Surely able to consistently see the truth about the first drink. More importantly, able to consistently see the truth about the defective thinking that always precedes that first drink, because it was never the first drink that got me drunk. It was always the defective thinking that took me to a place where somehow, some way, it made sense to me that that first drink would be possible yet again. Able to consistently see the truth about that, I'm also able to consistently see the truth of the ongoing defective thinking that underlies even that mind. My shortcomings and where I'm still selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, frightened, and inconsiderate, and where those defects can still affect my thinking, the egoic thinking mind, and take me back to that place. And most importantly, I'm able to consistently see the truth on a daily basis, that of myself I am nothing, and without developing, establishing first, and then deepening and broadening relationship with the power of God that can and will guide me and has removed this problem from me, I am doomed to repeat. Yet, when I engage in those simple daily disciplines, I can live on a daily basis, recovered, free, not looking over my shoulder, but walk freely into life with my head held high and some dignity in my life. Something that was never existed for the better part of 4 decades. What's it look like to be recovered? First and foremost, I say that I'm a recovered alcoholic, not with any arrogance or prideful boast of any nature. Quite the opposite. I say it with extreme humility. Because I was not the one that had anything to do with it. I've been moved from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body by the power of God. And as a result of that, for me to deny that I've recovered would be to deny the power of God at work in and through my life and the lives of so many others, both who introduced me to this program and continue to guide me today. This thing works. You know, my life today is radically different. My life today is to show up and to shout out the wonder and the wonderfulness and the absolute miracle of being able to walk a free man. You don't need to hide this in church basements. I walk freely, and everyone knows that what I was and what I am now. I get to be an example. Am I flawed? Absolutely. I'm still always will be that work in progress. What's it look like to be recovered on a practical basis? Again, it's not a line in the sand that I cross and never look back on. Quite the opposite. It's an ever-advancing line that I seek to strive to meet on an ongoing basis. Again, to those simple daily disciplines. Life is simple for me today. What's it look like to be recovered on a real practical basis? I drove down here today in a vehicle that has a spare tire. That spare tire is inflated. Yeah. I've got a jack, a lug wrench. There's proper tags on the vehicle. It's inspected. It's insured. I know, I paid the bill. Now, that's just normal. But back in the day, the occurrence of any and all of those things happening at any given point happened about as often as a full solar eclipse. It just wasn't part of the deal. Whatever junker would start up and he'd switch the plates around. Hey, I don't have to live like that around anymore. Life is simple. What's it look like to be recovered? I woke up today. I didn't just come to. And when I woke up, it was well before the crack of dawn, not the crack of noon. When I woke up, I was talking about drastic and revolutionary changes. I was in my own home, in my own bed, underneath a roof that's self-supporting through my own contributions. Now, there's tremendous change. What you got? Hey, you got something? You got a fifth? You got a quarter? You got some smokes? You got a 20? My hand was always out there. What do you got? I get to have my hand out there still today. Welcome. How you doing? You look like you're having a rough time. What can I do for you? Want to talk? Again, the same actions, but from a completely different point of heart. What does it look like to be recovered? When I woke up today, the biggest difference was that I was glad and grateful to be alive. Not just thankful. Thankful is easy. And grateful has nothing to do with a list. Gratitude, grateful, defined as acknowledging the benefits I've received and being willing to repay them in kind. Definition from 1934, Merriam-Webster Dictionary. To be grateful is to require action. Making a list ain't action. I know we have no outside opinions, but don't talk to me about, positive psychology and self-love and gratitude-less and all that stuff. You want to be grateful? Show me. So when I wake up with that first conscious breath of the day, and I'm grateful, I set myself up to owe. I'm an obligation to those who have carried this message and have helped me in any way, in shape, and form. And I owe that to them, and I owe it to all who I'm to meet today. in or out, doesn't matter, wherever I meet, you know, one or another of God's children, I owe them. How can I be helpful? How can I be useful? Here's my purpose in life today. That's what it looks like to be recovered. And I didn't do this on my own. What's it look like to be recovered? The words in our book tell us very simply. No longer fighting anyone or anything. I've been placed in a position of neutrality. I'm safe and protected. I'm held in God's loving arms. The problem no longer existed has been removed. The only time I think about, you know, booze or other substances is when I walk into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and need to discuss it. This has never been about the booze. Booze comes in bottles. Alcoholism comes in people. There's the difference. And I needed to deal with alcoholism. Unfortunately, I spent, you know, the better part of my first 10 years in and around this fellowship exposed to a way of life that was telling me that I needed to deal with the alcohol and not my alcoholism. And I love this fellowship. Mind you, I love this fellowship. This fellowship has saved my life, but I will do everything I can to help this fellowship grow in a direction that I see more akin to what the original early members were doing. And over the course of the next several weeks, what I hope to do is walk down that path with you and show you how I currently take someone through this process rapidly and quickly and without delay. And to the, as similar as I can, you know, to the way the early members did now. If you want to open up any amount of, we want to avoid controversy on outside issues, but it says nothing about controversy on inside issues. And if you want to develop, you know, controversy, just mention AA history, and, you know, you'll get all sorts of opinions and everything else like that. So, I am not an expert on the way the early members did. I've done a lot of investigation, and I have you know, spoken with many people who have done more investigating and study than I have, and have integrated that into a, you know, rapid and effective way of doing it, and it seems to work. And it's as similar as I know, you know, these days to the way the early members did it. Today's what? July 9th, 10th, something like that. 87 years ago, Bill Dodson, AA number 3, was sober 12 days. You know what he and Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob were doing in mid-July? They were hunting up and working with Eddie Galbraith, the Devil May Care, you know, chap. And so they weren't hanging around, hanging out. Well, you only got 10 days. What you really need to do is learn how to make coffee. You know, they had no time for that. You need to get to more meetings. There were no meetings. You know, they had no literature. They were doing all of this on the fly, but it worked. Were there failures? Absolutely. But for the ones who where it worked, it worked because they went at it with enthusiasm. Enthusiasm. The root of that is theos, God. With God. They did it with spirit. They did it because, you know, it was important that they do that for themselves and another, you know, hopeless chronic alcoholic might someday live. Ernie Galbraith, you know, ultimately died a drunk. But, you know, he was counted as AA number 4 for a while. But that's what was happening. You know, Bill Dodson was 10 days sober. Out of the hospital, only 7 or 8 days. 12 days sober, whatnot, you know. And they're back in the hospital talking to a newcomer. My experience back at, you know, I found this fellowship somewhere in the, about 20% of the way through the last century. And my experience was not being dragged to hospitals and talking to drunks, still, you know, wet drunks. I did actually have some experience going to homes with wet drunks and giving them booze and working with it, and those people got sober. I had nothing to do with that. I was just on the sidelines because I was a new kid, you know, back then. But in the early days, the early members went at it with gusto and vim and vigor, and they didn't waste time. You know, they didn't spend a lot of time cutting their way. You know, I don't go through this book page by page anymore with a newcomer. I don't have the time for that. What's my purpose? My purpose is to show someone else how to show someone else how to show someone else how to recover from alcoholism. If you want to learn something, teach. If you want to learn a subject, teach it. You don't have to know a lot about alcoholism to be able to help someone else. And when I say help someone else, I'm talking about effectively showing them our practical program of spiritual action. I need to arm myself with the facts. I need to be able to qualify a newcomer in a matter at best of an hour. As it turns out, you know, maybe sometimes a little bit longer. As it turns out, you know, my friend Chris is with me this evening, and we've known each other for a couple weeks, I guess, right? And I met him at a meeting. He raised his hand and said, "I'm present and I'm coming back." And so about, you know, 0.0006 tenths of a second after the amen at the end of the Lord's Prayer, I was, you know, in his face and began talking to him. And you know, other people were coming up and slapping him on the back and saying, "Hey, you want my phone number?" And, you know, it's like it's a, you know, and my approach was real simple. "Listen, do you want to get better for good and for all?" And what was your response?
"Yeah, absolutely."
"Yeah, absolutely." That, you know, because you didn't come, that was not your best day.
No.
No, it wasn't, you know. None of us showed, you know, the old expression, you know, the hardest step is the doorstep. You know, I mean, we experience our truth when we're out there. We experience our second step out, you know, consideration when we're out there. And we're almost on the verge of making a decision when we're out there. But, you know, then we have to cross the threshold and walk into this place, and we don't walk in on our best day. But that best day, it doesn't seem like our best day, but it actually is our best day, because all I have to do is say, "Yes, absolutely." And we, you know, got together and we met, and what did we do? We talked about why I drink like I did, and he could identify with it. And then we met again a couple days later with another buddy of mine, and we probably met for what, 2, 3, 4 hours maybe at your house, and we went through step two, the consideration of you know, your relationship to a power of your own understanding, and, you know, you made a decision. We prayed the third step prayer, and we began to talk about writing inventory. And the next day, you began writing inventory. And you know, so we're writing inventory after a matter of 3-4 hours. You know, and that's only because we talked a lot. But and that's what this book does. You know, this is a basic textbook. Because this, you know, right there in the foreword, because this book has become the basic text for our society, you know, we, you know, feel that no major changes have been made to it. And shoot, get it open to that. Because this book has become the basic text, a textbook. What is a textbook? A textbook is designed to communicate from the author, or authors in this case, you know, to the mind of the reader, the information that they want to share. It's set up as a simple problem-solving situation. Problem-solving situation is really very simple. If I have a problem, the first thing I have to do is identify exactly what the problem is. Once I know what the problem is, I then need to identify exactly what my solution is going to be to that problem. Then once I know what the problem is and what the solution is, then I need a practical program of action that that will take me from the problem to the solution. And when I introduce that problem, that solution into my life, and take the actions and steps necessary, the problem will be removed. Problem solved. In this case, how do I move from being a hopeless chronic alcoholic to a recovered alcoholic? There exists a sentiment against any radical changes being made, and therefore the first portion of this volume, the first 164 pages, describing the AA recovery problem, has been left untouched in the course of revisions made for both the second, third, and now the fourth edition. And then, in the foreword to the first edition, what does it tell me? That we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, and to show others precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. It's the main purpose of our fellowship. The main purpose of my existence today is to show others how to solve their problem. You know, Bill Wilson, when he talked about the legacy of service, he said, Alcoholics Anonymous is more than a set of principles. It is a fellowship, it's a society of recovered alcoholics in action. And then he goes on to describe some of the actions necessary to take. Some of them are very mundane and practical, like, you know, making phone calls and perhaps, you know, making coffee and whatnot. But mostly he talks about showing someone how to carry this message to the hopeless chronic alcoholic. Because my purpose with Chris is not for him to get better. I don't have the power to make Chris better. He doesn't have the power to make Chris better. I'm still as powerless over alcohol as I was when I was in my cups. He's still as powerless over alcohol as you know, he was when we first met, and always will be. But what I can do is show him a way that he can develop a relationship with power, with the power of God, so that he can develop that on his own, find the freedom, and then turn around and show someone else. And he doesn't need to spend a lot of time learning a lot of stuff to do it. How do you learn something? You teach it. You should find another drunk and show him how to do it. Could that work? Well, it has in all sorts of cases. Let me give you an example. My father worked at Picatinny Arsenal up in Dover for 45, 46 years, something like that. Started off actually putting in fence posts back in the early 30s. And ultimately ended up third highest civilian on the base. But what he did was he applied himself and made, you know, some progress, you know, through the positions that he held. And then in 1941, when war was declared, of course, he was working in a defense plant, so he was exempted from the draft. So he just kept showing up at Picatinny Arsenal as a civilian defense employee and doing the same job as he was doing. And then one day, a bus pulled up, and his entire department was put on the bus, and they went down to Newark Broad Street and ushered into a building, and they were all issued uniforms, and they raised their hands, and they were inducted into the Army, and they all got back on the bus, and they went back to Picatinny Arsenal, and they did exactly the same job as they were doing. They just were now members of the Army, and they were wearing a uniform, which was, I guess, easier on my mother because she didn't have to do any laundry as much as that. But, you know, and everything was fine. Because of his general service rating, he was inducted as a master sergeant because he had achieved a supervisory level of some sort. And so then the Army, in their infinite wisdom, decided that they needed a master sergeant drill instructor down in Fort Hood, Texas. So he got his transfer orders to go down to Fort Hood, Texas, and teach all the new recruits basic training. Except he'd never gone through basic training. He was just up in Dover doing the same job he'd always been doing. And as he's telling the story, I said, "So what did you do?" And he said, "I just stayed one page ahead of him every night in the book. You know, he just had to stay far enough ahead so that he could get, you know, come back the next day and teach him what he had learned that night by staying up and studying." And he said, "And also, I had other master sergeants around who actually knew how to do this stuff, and I'd ask them questions about it." You know? So, you know, what I've told Chris is that, you know, when you're taking someone new through the process and they ask you a question you don't know the answer to, your answer is real simple. "That's a great question. Let's find someone who knows the answer. Bless you." You know? I don't know the answers to everything, but it's the enthusiasm, "That's a great question. Let's go find an answer for it." You know, it has nothing to do with what you know and everything to do with your enthusiasm about it. You know, Bill and Bob were enthusiastic. They had found a way out. They were thrilled with this. They wanted to share this. Bill had been sober 5 months. And, Dr. Bob was sober, 1 month, 3 weeks actually, but it doesn't matter. They realized, and a lot of that was, you know, as the benefit of what Silkworth had talked about with Bill Wilson, is because Bill had absolutely no success in New York. Because he was, you know, hammering home the whole idea of you got to have a spiritual awakening, you got to have a spiritual experience, you got to have a spiritual experience, you got to have this white light, you know, experience, you know, and the drunks down at the Calvary Church weren't buying it. And until Silkworth said, "Listen, you got to hammer home the hopelessness of this situation. You got to kill them with their, you know, the idea that they can't drink safely because of the allergy of the body. And you can't." You know, and then once you get that into their heads, then you got to, you know, really level them with the idea that their mind can't see that they have a mind of obsessed, a compulsive obsession about needing relief. This is something pretty much what I talked to Chris about in both the first evening and then when we spent about an hour later, you know, talking about what makes me an alcoholic. Silkworth gives it to us in his, you know, in the doctor's opinion. But can I share this with someone else simply and coherently and rapidly? When I take a drink of alcohol, I get I get an okay feeling, but I get mostly a not enough feeling when a drink. When I get a second drink of alcohol, I finally begin to get that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once with a couple. But also what comes at once with that couple is that sense of needing more. Because once I put that second one in me, before I know it, and without me even knowing it, my body begins to crave that third one. And I want that third one more than I want that first two. And I want that fourth one more than those first three. And that feeling is always, always, always intensified, never, ever, ever satisfied. And I'm not done with alcohol until alcohol is done with me, until I'm either locked up, passed out, or somehow separated from the substance. You know, you want to scare me sober, quick, fast, and hurry up, call, last call. Holy crap! Where's my supply? Can I get a six-pack to go? Is there an after-hours joint? I got to. Do you understand? Got to have it. That's what happens when it's in me. And if that's all it was, it would be an allergic reaction that I, you know, would be able to abstain from and see that I have consequences. But unfortunately, I don't see that because I have a mind that can't see the truth about that. Because I don't see what booze does to me, I see what booze does for me. All those people that I talked about, you know, that ask that question for generations, you know, what are you going to do with the likes of someone like me? They talked to me about my drinking. And it made sense, particularly when I was, you know, hung down and brung down and you know, were, you know, caught up and jammed up in dire straits. You know, and I would listen to them and I would want to live up to them. Just, please, just behave yourself, you know, tonight. Just for tonight, just behave yourself. And or just, can you just not drink so much? You know, and I wanted to live up to all of those, you know, plaintive pleas from people that really were cared about me and wanted to help me. I just couldn't do it. Because they could talk to me about my drinking. But what they couldn't do was talk to me about my thirst. And what I thirst for is that sense of relief, that sense of ease and comfort that comes at once. I don't thirst for the drink, I want the relief. The relief that the booze gives me, what the booze gives me is my final, it finally takes me to a place where I'm normal. What I'd always wanted to be, when I get to that point of, this is how life should be. But then I'm always chasing that. I don't see what it does to me, I see what it does for me. So you can't talk to me about my drinking, you have to talk to me about my thirst. But I'm not really interested in that until I'm actually at the point of that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. That's when I know my thirst. And I know that it's unquenchable. And it can never, ever be satisfied. And I have a mind that can't see the truth that I can't drink safely because I'm so focused on the relief. It has nothing to do with the booze and everything to do with the relief. You know, and you know, because there's way off in the distance, there's a tiny, tiny little sign that says, relief. And in front of me, there's all those, you know, don't go this way, you know, bridge out. You know, I'd turn back if I were you. You know, and you know, and it doesn't matter. I'm going over through the ramp, anything, bridge out. I don't care. Let's just rev that engine up, and we'll go over the gap, whatever it takes. I gotta get to relief. I can't see that I can't drink safely because my mind isn't focused on control. My mind is, you know, focused on enjoyment. It has nothing to do with reality and everything to do with the long sought after relief that I had years ago. And I've been chasing something in a tail that's never going to come around again. And maybe, with a lot of therapeutic changes in my, you know, behavioral therapy, maybe if I just concentrate and just not drink one day at a time, one silly miserable day at a time, you know, if maybe if I could just get through today and just get through to my meeting and then just get through till tomorrow, maybe I'd be able to successfully not drink. And my experience was, without a program of recovery in my life, without a relationship with God, without some daily disciplines, what my life looked like was exactly that for 10 miserable years. You know, when I came into this fellowship, I literally, there was, no one ran up to me with a big book and said, hey, this is going to save your life. What they said was, hey, sit back, relax, take it easy. I can follow instructions, and I can take it really easy, and I can relax a lot. And they told me, you know, try to identify, not compare. Of course, I'm comparing myself to you, and I'm not identifying with any of you. You know, and you know, so we have but I hung around long enough, and we had, you know, some more slogans, and I learned, you know, what the slogans were, what the appropriate responses to the slogans were, and so we'd have a good time slinging slogans back and forth and, you know, back and cleaning up ashtrays back in the day. But there was one slogan I absolutely could not stand, and it was, you know, it was like fingernails on the blackboard of my existence. It was like, keep coming, it gets better. No, it doesn't. And if your experience was that the only thing you needed to do was show up in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, put your butt in a chair, drink some coffee, maybe make a lot of coffee, and you know, just, you know, go to a lot of meetings and just not drink one silly, stupid day at a time, I wish you another 100 years of that. That simply was not my experience. My experience was exactly the opposite of that. My life did not get better. It got decidedly worse. Sure, I wasn't drinking one day at a time, but, you know, without a relationship with God, without daily disciplines, without a practical program of action, and, you know, without leading, you know, accepting and leading a spiritual way of life, my life did not get better. It got so worse that I'm not drinking, but I'm going out on all sorts of other sprees, eating sprees, spending sprees, you know, sex sprees, rage sprees. You know, there's a great one. You look at me sideways, and I'm exploding on you, and then before I know it, you know, I come out of it, it's like, well, that's never going to happen again. And then you look at me, you know, from the other side, right? and I'm exploding again. And it's like, where is this coming from? You know, and there were people in my life that you know, would, I think, wish that I would drink. Because at least then they would know why I was being such a idiot. And they use more colorful language. But we'll leave it at that. But, you know, that was my experience. And to give you an idea of where that took me, just not drinking one silly, stupid, miserable day at a time. I'm not drinking. But I'm a winner today. You know, I literally put the SOB in sober. You know, I mean, I was just a good for nothing. And I'm in my mid-40s, and I'm living in my car on a rest area on an interstate, and I think life's just grand because no one's bothering me. You know, my mantra has finally come true. I'm fine, leave me alone. I'm fine. Leave me alone. Just leave me alone, okay? I'm fine. And, you know, and when you're living on a rest area on an interstate, you're left alone. And so I got my wish, you know. But let's establish a bar, you know. Being in your mid-40s and living in your car in a rest area, it's not normal behavior. No matter how you try to cut it, it's just not normal behavior. I would race home to the interstate, your rest area, so I could put the seat back and turn the radio on and listen to John Sterling broadcasting Yankee games. And I loved it when they were on the West Coast because the game would start, you know, after 10 o'clock and finish up by 12:30, 1 o'clock or something like that. And I'd be tired enough when the game was over. In the post game, I'd turn it off and fall asleep. But when they're playing at the stadium, and the game starts at 7 or 8 and finishes up by 10, 10:30, or unless it's a Red Sox game, then who knows how long it's going to go on. But, you know, I turn the radio off and I'm stuck in a car with someone who I absolutely cannot stand, and I'm the only one there. You know, the untenableness of life had closed in so much that, you know, I just, there was, even just listening to the radio was nothing but a distraction. Just one more distraction from having to face a life that was unlivable. And ultimately, what that took me to was, you know, I brought back to that rest area the only thing that had ever happened, you know, ever worked in my life, which came in the form of a bottle, and another, in short order, my, car is gone, the rest area is gone, the license is gone, I'm living on the streets, and ultimately living in the woods. And even then, still, you know, I was left alone. Even the bears left me alone up in North Jersey. But and the state of my existence on any given day at that point was as simple as this. I would come to, at some point during the day, I would immediately curse God for having me awake, and then go to town and seek and find provisions in whatever size bottle I could afford that day, achieve oblivion, next day repeat. Come to, curse God, go to town, seek and find oblivion, then repeat. Day after day after day after day after day after day after day. And one day, I don't know when it was, and never will, and doesn't matter, something to the extent of this came out of my mouth. God, either take me out or show me the way. And immediately after that, curse of a challenge of a prayer escaped my lips. It was off the town to seek oblivion that day, and the next, and the next, and the next, and the next, and the next. And one day, and I don't know when it was, but here I am, knocking on Mommy and Daddy's door. And they opened their door to a sick son that they had long ago and rightfully so cast out, and yet with all the love and compassion and care and concern for a sick child, they allowed me into their home. Now they're in their late 70s, early 80s, living out their golden years as well they should. But they brought me into their home, and in short order, my parents began to experience what our literature talks about as our four terrible horsemen. They began to experience terror, courtesy of moi. They began to know bewilderment. They lived a life of frustration, and they intimately knew despair. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Those are the finest qualities that I have to offer to the party. That's what I bring to the table, you know. Terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. Because, you know, I don't suffer well, and I don't suffer alone. I freely share all my misery with anybody around me. I'm a Teflon, I want no part of it. You can have it. You do with it. You deal with it. You know, terrible wilderness, frustration, and despair. If that's the best I have. How about I put that on my eHarmony profile, huh? Hey, who wants a bit of this, you know? It's like, that's, you know, Then one day following a, just to continue it up, a violent confrontation with my father, I found myself facing a teacher one more time. He happened to be wearing a sidearm, had a badge in a blue uniform, and I happened to be wearing his bracelets. And he asked me a simple question. He said, listen, I can take you to jail or I can take you to detox. Jail or detox, what's it going to be? And I thought about it. And I thought about it, 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 because that's what I do. I think about it. I've got this thinking, racing mind, that thinking, racing mind that is always so focused on the relief that I don't, can't see it, and I think that I'm in charge, and I think that I'm in control, and I think I can think my way out of this, and I don't realize that whatever, you know, that it's this thinking mind that got me into this situation in the first place. No matter what harebrained solution I come up with, it's just going to be out of the fat and into the fire of my next disaster that I come up with. And I'm thinking, and I'm thinking, and I'm thinking, and at that point, that thinking mind just ceased, stopped. I didn't know it then, but I know it now, that at that point, I was done. I was nothing but an open, stinking, pustulated wound of alcoholism that didn't know enough to fall over and die. I didn't know it then, but I know it now, that at that point, I was at the end of my rope. I didn't know it then, but I know it now, that at that point, that curse of a challenge or a prayer that escaped my lips days or weeks before, when I knew what my truth was, and I knew what my solution was, and I just couldn't have the guts to face it, and I was trying to drown myself away into a bottle, was being answered at that very moment. Facing that fine officer, when he asked me a very simple question. What's it going to be? Are you in or are you out? A question that would be offered to me many times since then. Am I in or am I out? And it usually comes down to something as simple as that. Am I in or am I out? There's no just touching your foot in. I can't just stick my toe in. I've got to dive in. Ultimately, I ended up briefly in a jail cell, and then to a detox, and then to a rehab, and then to a rescue shelter, and ultimately to my home group, the Indaction Big Book Group, where they, again, as what we'll look and talk about over the next 5 weeks, is they rapidly and quickly qualified me and took me through this program of action in just a matter of days. And it was as simple as that. You know, they talked to me about the analogy of the body. They talked to me about a mind obsessed with relief. Their experience with it, the experience in this book, and I was able to match it. They listened to some of my experience, you know. And they said, you know, do you drink like we did? And I said, yep. And, you know, they said, are you, you know, they said, they didn't tell me to sit back, relax, and listen. What they did was, you know, listen, fella, you're dying of a fatal, progressive, hopeless disease. And if you don't do something about it, you're going to die. And then they looked at me and said, maybe that's not such a bad idea. I said, because at least you wouldn't be bothering so many people anymore. Made sense. So I was bothering anybody I came around. Terrible bewilderment, frustration, and despair. You can have it. I don't want it. I said, but maybe, just maybe, we doubt it, but maybe there's a chance that if you pay some attention to what we did and try to put some of it into your life, there might just be someone out there that you might be able to be helpful to. Like I said, we doubt it, but we'll give you a shot at it. Yeah. They took it and gave it away, but they did it with enthusiasm. They did it with a smile on my face. They told me I was a big dummy, but they did it with a smile on my face. And they made me feel somewhat important every time, you know. And they said, you know, so again, they said, are you in or you out? You know, do you want to go through this? And I said, well, why not? You know, I said, well, I guess so. And then he whooped me upside the head and said, well, you know, how about flipping that around with a little bit of the excitement? You know, we're offering you something that's going to change your entire life around. Oh, okay. You know, I don't have to have an understanding of it then. I just need it because I didn't have an experience with it then. What took me to that point was the brief yet still at that point fading memory, because my ego, egoic thinking mind, will always fade away all that unpleasantness. The desperation that I experience in all of those places of hopelessness and despair will disappear rapidly and quickly once my thinking mind begins to reform and regroup and say, hey, it really wasn't as bad as that or that. It really wasn't. You can handle it this time. You've had that experience, right? Does it end well? No, it doesn't end well. But it doesn't matter how it ends, but if I learn from it. That's all this is. It's just another learning cycle that I get to enjoy. So we get to... But that was my experience in terms of rapidly and quickly going through first the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind. And I'll finish up with this, and then we'll open it up to comments and questions. This was my experience. I know I can't drink safely now because I have an allergy of the body that once I put it in me, it triggers a reaction where my, and we'll go into it in detail next week, where it triggers a reaction where I can't stop drinking until alcohol is done with me. And I have a mind that can't see that truth because I don't see what it does to me, I see only what it does for me, and I'm only focused on the relief. It doesn't matter what the delivery vehicle is. And then, like, maybe the, you know, therapeutic methods would work if it wasn't for that third and final element, that malady of spirit. That malady of spirit that in my life manifests as a malady of more and never satisfied. Sure, I want to, you know, because ultimately I think all my life I've been running, thinking that I'm in control, that I can somehow manage my life, that somehow I can run the show, and not only run my show, but all of your shows. And but I'm blocked off from any power that can and will successfully guide me. Because I'm blocked off from power that can and will guide me, I suffer from that malady of more and never satisfied, and it manifested in like this. You know, sure, I wanted more booze, I could never get enough of that, and I wanted more of other substances, I could never get enough of that, but it wasn't just substances. I wanted more power, more prestige, more money, more food, more sex, more love, more of anything on the outside to make me feel better on the inside. And when I had it, it was good, but it's never good enough, because it's never good enough. I always have to have more, because I always have to have more. I'm always chasing, because I'm always chasing. I'm never satisfied, because I'm never satisfied. I always have to have more, and I'm dissatisfied, and I get restless, I get irritable, I get discontent, I can't stand the intent of life, and before I know it, it makes absolute perfect sense. Boom, and the plug comes out of the jug, and I ingest the substance, I trigger the allergy, and there's my endless loop of alcoholism. Period. That's all I need to know. Step one doesn't tell me that I can't drink, it tells me that I'm doomed to repeat. I'm absolutely doomed to repeat. I have no power, choice, and control. I'm so screwed. And that's the greatest place in the world to be. I mentioned that I was at the, you know, I was at the jumping off point. I was at the end of my rope. I now know that the most glorious place in the world for me to be is at the end of my rope. Because when I'm at the end of my rope, the only thing I can do is to let go. And when I let go on that fateful day, I was caught by the loving hands of God who finally delivered me all to you, to all of you. Thank you so very much. We'll see you, and we'll open up to comments and gentle questions.